September the 24th, 1400 hours. My diary. Travelling up narrow mountain road, frequent stops to let farm cattle go past. Mountains each side, towering over us like Dormio's drawings in Dante's Paradise Lost. Not only is Dante's Paradise lost, but we are bloody lost. Lieutenant Button is looking studiously at his map. The wrong way up. It's upside down, sir. I know that! I turned it upside down for a reason. Sorry, sir. I was only trying to help. Well, if you want to help, Milligan, act like a Basenji. Basenji? Basenji? He got me. What was Basenji? A platoon of battle-weary soldiers are filtering past us to the rear. Their shoulder flashes read, Queens. September the 24th, evening. My diary. Owing to the non-arrival of number 19 and 21 wireless sets, no battery OP can be established. Ordered to stand down. Now to let you have the boredom of the official history of the regiment. There, 19 battery position lay at the foot of Monte Mango and was approached by means of roads little better than mountain tracks, worse indeed than those encountered in Africa. Yet by evening, after a day of feverish activity and some quite unprincipled borrowing of equipment, cigarettes, chocolate, etc., they were in action and were immediately given the attention of Stukas. Now, Gunner Edgington recalls the first gun position. Action, lights, cameras. I recall travelling on one of the Scammels as we went into action. We travelled 14 miles, I remember Bombardier Dean saying, yet we found out later the bridge there was only 2 miles in depth. It had been started just 2 weeks before, and though we didn't know it then, Jerry was well advanced on the task of chucking us right out. One man, a surgeon sergeant of our battery by the name of Mick Bullprick Ryan, was to completely reverse the situation almost single-handed. We didn't get moving till late in the day and then crept along an interminable, winding, torturous course until long after nightfall we came into an earth road between the giant trees of what seemed like a forest, except they were set strangely in very orderly straight rows. There were smaller trees between them, apples or lemons, and running suspended along all of them, grapevines, all of them loaded with their fruit fully ripe, for it was September and time of the harvest. No light but Button's torch. Everyone inhibited from any noise that was avoidable. A hissed instruction, and the driver swung his wheel, the huge vehicle grinding slowly into the vines, tearing great lengths of them away. The torches showed great puddles of what seemed like blood in the soft, rhicorn-sprouting earth. It was, in fact, grape juice. Trees, these giants carried masses of very fine walnuts, were dragged down by two Scammel arranged fanwise to a particular tree, with a powerful steel hawser running from one front winch gear around the tree to the other front winch. A line of fire was being cleared. Next morning, a raid, Spike and Duke, shaving, dived under a Scammel. Fire orders kept coming and kept getting cancelled. We could see Monte Stella through the trees, like a kid's drawing of an out, and watched our infantry struggling on it. Then the most incredible shoot of them all. Mick knocked the top clean off it with 2 rounds, sighting through the barrel of a 7.2 howitzer aimed like a pistol. Suddenly a great ragged mob of Hun fighter planes interceded, surging over the nearest crest, bellying down right over our treetops, cannons going, the weather at us I know not. Yes, I remember being Stukas. The evidence of this was a 6-foot-deep trench, at the bottom of which, looking up white-faced and saying, "Tell Hitler I'm sorry," was Lance Bombardier Milligan. What did Basenji mean? My slit trench was in the angle of a farm hut wall and a raised bank. All day, Jerry 155mm shells were passing over our positions. "Or, they're after the 25-pounders in the field behind us," said Sergeant Ryan. "Behind," I said, turning yellow. "Christ, we're far forward for heavy guns." "Forward," he giggled. "We had bloody Nebelwerfers in this field this afternoon." Ryan had excelled himself. In the absence of an observation post, he had aligned his gun on Monte Mango by looking up the barrel, elevating it a bit above that, and by God, he was actually dropping the shells right on target. I was surplus to requirements, so I spent the afternoon writing letters and eating handfuls of purple grapes that grew above my trench. I read about conquerors partaking of the spoils of war. What I hadn't read about was the terrifying attacks of the ships that followed. Dear Mum, Dad and Des, we've been moved. I'm not allowed to say where. But we had spaghetti for lunch. The lunacy continues and has every chance of becoming a way of life unless we stop it soon. Men are getting so used to wars that the psychiatric wing of the RAMC are planning how to break the news to the men when the war is over. I'm keeping well. We don't go hungry in this war. The compo rations are very good. That's if you get to the box first. This is the first day in this country, so I haven't caught anything yet. I would welcome any books, periodicals and newspapers, preferably one that say the war is over. And believe me, the war is over. It's over here. I'm writing this in a hole in the ground. It's convenient because if you get killed, they just fill the hole in and sell it as a cemetery. That's all the cheery news. We'll write again when the situation is a little bit less fraught. Loving son, Terry. I lit up a cigarette and lay back, mind a blank. The guns roar. The night comes. Grapevine messages. Dinner! Across the field with mess tins, I'm walking on a field that has been laying fallow for years. One still feels the furrows where the plough once moved. In the corner of the field, under some walnut trees, a heavily camouflaged cookhouse is operating, and by the screams, they are operating without an anaesthetic. In the queue, I find Kidgel and Edgington. "Where have you been hiding?" is the merry greeting. "Hiding? Me hiding? That's a malicious rumour. I haven't been hiding. I've been standing on the peak of a mountain, swayed in the Union Jack with a searchlight beaming on me, and I've been crying out, 'Come on, you German swines, and feel the taste of British steel!' Do you call that hiding?" "No, we call it a load of cobblers." "Talking of cobblers," said Kidgel, "what are those terrible things floating in the stew?" "Mines," said our cook, "but don't worry, they're ours." It is a McConaughey stew, and it tastes bloody marvellous. We sit with our backs against a Bren carrier. The odd gun falls silent as the gun teams take their turns for their meal. It's dark now. All around is the unending roar of artillery. Odd rumours. "They say he's starting to pull out and our patrols are on the outskirts of Naples."
"Core Naples?"
"Yes. We would all like to be in Naples. It would be the first European city since we left England nearly 2 years ago. We'd all been warned of the dangers. If the brochure was telling the truth, venereal disease was walking the streets of Naples, and one could contract it by just shaking hands with a priest. The BQMS has passed us a message saying there won't be any mail for a week. He says things like that to cheer us up. Amid the gunfire, we hear a droning. A lone plane. It's a Jerry. He drops a green flare. It was so pretty, we all cheered when it came on. "Milligan! Milligan!" A voice is calling. "Is that you, Mother?" I reply. It's Bombardier Fuller. He says, "Pack enough kit to last 48 hours. You're going up to the OP." Enough to last 48 hours. Wearily, I climb into Bombardier Sherwood's Bren carrier. Already in and waiting are Captain Sullivan, Signaller Birch, and Bombardier Edwards. In a second carrier are Lieutenant Button, Signaller Wenham, and I cannot recall the driver. If I did, he wouldn't hear me now. My diary. Got onto a narrow road to Mango. Road jammed with vehicles. 2 trucks ahead stuck by Jerry mortars. Stuck for nearly 2 hours. Progress is slow. Road jammed with vehicles. Very dark now. Ahead is a glow of a large fire. Lieutenant Button dismounts. He's coming towards us with a face that says Confusion Unlimited, and he appears to be the managing director.
"That's the mountain up there."
He points to a mountain that is big enough it doesn't need pointing to. Still, I take his point. "We've got to get up there." "We need a ladder, sir." "How are we going to get a Bren carrier up there?" says Birch. "We post it," I said. He tried to hit me. "I'll miss him," I said. "Ooh," said Birch, a helmsman whose face showed white through the wheelhouse. It's really dark. We can hear the small arms fire ahead. The crump of mortars is endless. What was Basenji? There is now a nose-to-tail traffic jam along the narrow walled lane. The red glow ahead is getting larger and now owns the sky. Some walking wounded are squeezing past. "What's happening?" I said to one of them.
"Jerry mortars. They set fire to an ammo truck. Any minute now, it'll all go up."
He had hardly said it when there was an explosion and random fireworks of the ammo going off showered the sky with sparks. It was great fun and costing us a fortune.
A military policeman is coming down the convoy. "Back up if you can," he says and laughs.
We pass the message down the line. Half an hour later, we start to move backwards. A dispatch rider is riding up from down behind and calling out,
"Any 19 battery here? Any 19 battery here?"
Bert says,
"Yes." "Silly sod. Never answer anything in the army. It's too late now."
It's Donar Lawrence. He tells us we have to take the Bren carrier and go back to pick up a wireless set which has just arrived from the beach. And Captain Sullivan on another truck is going to go to the OP, so we breathe a sigh of relief. We start extricating the Bren carrier from the congestion.
Marvellous! When we've almost got it out, the bloody thing breaks down. We struggle and manage to push it onto the side to allow the traffic through.
Button tells us, we'll have to walk to HQ and get fresh orders. I tell him I don't need fresh orders. I'm perfectly satisfied with the ones I've got.
Please, Milligan, said Button, try and be a soldier.
We finally reach HQ. It's off a walled lane in an Italian farmhouse built around a forecourt, two stories high. An exterior staircase leads up to the first floor, which is surrounded by a balcony. The farm is blacked out except the room where our HQ is. That is a mass of light jigs coming from windows and doors, like an early Sony Lumiere. Several vehicles are parked in the forecourt. The drivers are asleep in the back. 20 minutes pass. Mr. Budden appears. He smells of whiskey, the khaki aftershave for men. He's much happier by now.
"We are not needed, Milligan," he says.
Does that mean for the duration, I thought. We both walk back to the gun position, which is quite easily found. We just follow the loudest bangs. September the 24th, 1943, my diary. Cool night, a touch of autumn chill in the air. Had very disturbed sleep. Kept waking up in a cold sweat. Took a swig at water bottle. Had a fag. What a bloody life. I finally dropped off in a black sleep. Am I the black sleep of the family?
September the 25th, 1943. I awoke at first light. I sat up and yawned. I felt as tired as though I had not slept. A morning mist is rapidly disappearing. It swirls around the head of Monte Mango. I start the ritual of folding my blankets. A voice calls.
Hey, Terry! Terry!
Terry? I hadn't been called that since I became khaki. It was Reg Lake, a captain in the Queen's Regiment. He'd been sleeping about 30 yards away. Reg was the pre-war manager of the New Era Rhythm Boys, one of the best semi-pro bands in London. He was the one who gave me my first break as a crooner. The last time I'd seen him was on a 137 bus going from Broccoli to Victoria. My God, Terry, what are you doing in this godforsaken place?
I'm helping England win the war.
What a bloody silly question. Reg, I said, or do I call you sir?
Look, he said, how long have you been here, he said.
I came yesterday. I thought it was a day trip.
I was here on the landings. You missed all the fun.
Oh, I said, I'll try and make up for it. It was difficult to make conversation. I couldn't say, where's the band playing this week? I asked what had happened to the boys in the band.
Oh, all split up, he said. That must be painful.
Most of them are in the services. Do you remember Tom, the tenor player with only one lung?
Well, they took him.
Oh, well, they took me, and I've only got two. He was called away by a sergeant. I never saw him again. I've no idea if he survived the war. If he reads this book, I hope he gets in touch. A voice is calling across the land.
Bombardier Milligan! Bombardier Milligan!
Bombardier Milligan is dead, I called in a disguised voice.
The voice replied, then he's going to miss breakfast.
Good God, it's nearly nine.
I just get to the cookhouse in time to have the remains of powdered egg, bacon and tea that appears to have been all cooked together.
You slept late, said Edgington.
Yes, sir, I said, I'm training for sleeping sickness. We are now gathered around the water truck doing our ablutions. Edgington is the lather stage, peering into a mirror the size of a half-crown propped in a mudguard. He was moving his face clockwise as he shaved. I had slipped to the waist, which brought cries of, where are you? I had my head under the tap. enjoying the refreshing cascade of chlorinated water, at which time 12 FW-109s are enjoying roaring out of the sun, guns hammering. There's a god-awful scramble. We all meet under a lorry. I caught a glimpse of the planes as they launched their bombs on the 25-pounder regiment behind us. "Look out!" warns Edgington when the planes were halfway back to Germany. He'd hurled himself face down. Suddenly it was all over. We stand up. Edgington presented a face, half lather, dust and squashed grapes. What was I laughing at? One moment I was well, next moment I was on my knees vomiting. It was unbelievable. I became giddy, kept seeing stars and the Virgin Mary upside down. "Oh, report 6, said Bombardier Fuller. "You're so kind," I said. They took me to the doc, who said I had a temperature of 103. "What have you been doing?" he said. I was washing, sir. He didn't believe me. Having a temperature of 103 allowed you to stop fighting. No, but seriously, folks, I was ill. Oh, I was ill. The war would have to go on without me. In the Bren carrier, they took me shivering with ague to the forward dressing station. It was a small, tented area off a rough track. A lance corporal, tall, thin, with spectacles, took my details and tied a label on me, and I think it said, "This way up." "That stretcher there," he said. "So they were going to stretch me." I felt a bit of a fraud. I forget which bit I felt. Around me were seriously wounded men. Some were moaning softly. A chubby Catholic priest, about 45, red-faced, blonde hair, going grey, walked among us. "And what's wrong with you, son?" "I've got fever." "Fever?" "Yes, sir. Disappointed, father." He grinned, but didn't wipe the sadness off his face. He told me they were waiting for the arrival of some badly wounded men from the Queen's. "They were trying to take that," he nodded towards Monte Stella. Three jeeps arrived with stretcher cases. Among them is a German, his face almost off. Poor bastard. There was a trickle of wounded all afternoon. Some walking, some on stretchers, some dead. The priest went among them carrying out the last rites. Was this the way Christ wanted them to go? The most depressing picture of the war was, for me, the blanket-covered bodies on stretchers, those boots protruding from the end. For my part, I kept falling into delirious sleep, where I told General Montgomery to sing God Save America with his trousers down. When I awoke, it was evening. I'd been laying there for about 4 hours. "Are they going to take me?" I asked an orderly. "Yes, you're next, Corporal," he comforted. "We had a lot of badly wounded. We had to send them off first. Understand?" And I understood. With the sun setting and the tent sides turning pink in the light, I was loaded aboard an ambulance into the top bunk. The top bunk. It all came back to me. The top bunk. That's the one my parents always put me in during those long train journeys across India on the old GIP railway. It was all so long ago. The ambulance bumped and jolted through the narrow mountain roads. And I recall those bright, sunlit Indian days as a boy, and every day was like a Kipling story. "Like a drink of water, Corporal?" "Yes." The attendant poured water into a tin mug. I gulped it down in two. It tasted like nectar. It was four stretchers to an ambulance. In between, with his back to the driving cab, sat an orderly. The inside was painted white. The vehicle smelt new. A blood plasma bottle was attached to the soldier on the lower bunk, his chest swathed in bandages. The orderly constantly checked the flow of the blood plasma. The German kept groaning. It all seemed to be coming to me through a heat-charged mist. I was hovering twixt delirium and reality. Finally, I dozed off. The ambulance stops. Nearby artillery are banging away. The doors open. It's dark. A voice mixed with gunfire. I'm being unloaded. I'm on the ground. From there, a large municipal building with a flat roof is silhouetted against the sky. Covered with ivy, it looks like the setting for Gormenghast. I'm carried upstairs, long corridors, more stairs, and finally into a dim-lit ward of about 30 beds, all with mozzie nets down. I'm placed on the floor. "Can you undress yourself?" said an overworked orderly. Yes, I can. "The pyjamas under the pillow." He points to a bed. My God, it looked good. Already turned down. White sheets and pillows. Two pillows. Being ill was paying dividends. I pull on the standard blue pyjamas. "Where's the Kazi?" I said weakly. He pointed out the door. "It's dead opposite." I wasn't quite dead, but I went opposite. That journey over, I pulled my body under the seats. I was desperately tired and feverish, but stayed awake to enjoy the luxury of sheets. Another orderly. They all wear gym shoes, so you don't hear them coming. He took my pulse, temperature,
entered them on a board that hung on the foot of the bed.
"You like some tea?" he spoke Yorkshire.
"Aye," I said in Yorkshire.
"Anything to eat?"
"Yes, anything." He came back with a plate of tomato soup and bread. On the tray were four white tablets.
"Take these when you're done. They help bring the temperature down."
"I don't want it down," I said. "I want it up for the duration." I gulped the soup down and took the tablets and brought them all up. Who said Romans was dead? So much for my first 48 hours in Italy.